Okay. So today's main topic is going to be logical inference. So that's why we have Monty Python's logic there. Before I go there, I'll complete some loose ends we have left from last class on alpha beta pruning, and also something about quiescence, which is the depth to which you do limited depth evaluation. Okay. I put up project 2, which is essentially directly doing tic-tac-toe with min-max, full min-max, as well as limited depth min-max evaluation. Okay. Any questions before we go forward? Yes, sir. What? Uh-huh. I mean, basically, I'll explain you the technique as to how to change the code. You have to figure out.
No, I mean, did you explain that already?
Yes, last class. Were you there?
Yeah,
oh, it's called, see, remember that, I mean, I'll actually do an example of alpha beta again today because you guys were supposed to have done it at home, and I want to just see, basically the bounce-based pruning of the min-max, that's called alpha beta pruning. Okay, good, that's fine. Other questions? Okay. So, let's do a couple of the loose ends that I said we should complete. Okay, you guys have done this? Who have done the alpha beta pruning? Yes, okay, so you passed, others questionable. So, how many things did you cut off? What? So that means you'll just cut off here, okay? That's the only thing you cut off. Okay, anybody else done it at all? Okay. So we can talk. I can explain to you. You almost got it correct. You also have to cut this off. The other guys don't need any explanation. I think it was too obvious for them that we don't need to do it. So it's clear. It's definitely right that J node has to be cut off. But by the time you come here, you would be less than or equal to 3. That thing is greater than or equal to 4. So there's no point in looking at this. It's only one node being cut off, but might as well. Okay. Okay, so let me just do this very quickly on the board. I just figured out, not because I want to help you guys out. I mean, I don't want to help people who don't want to help themselves, but I found that I can do symposium thing with this pen, so I want to try that out. You go for the, once you have looked at the E and F, you would have figured out that this is 4, okay? As soon as you have figured out that's 4, this would be greater than or equal to 4. That's an alpha bound. And once you have greater than or equal to 4 there, you come down to C, come down to G, and you have looked at G, and C is now less than or equal to 6, having looked at G. And then you come down again to H, come down to M. When you see M, H is greater than or equal to 3. Is there any cutoff? No. It's an alpha-beta cutoff. It's not alpha-alpha cutoff or a beta-beta cutoff. Okay? There's nothing inconsistent in those things right now. So then you look at N2, and it's become 4. So in fact, this thing, the whole thing becomes 4. Okay? Now, because this is 4, this thing actually has become less than or equal to 4. Okay? Now, the question is there any cutoff? So this guy is saying that I already have something as good as 4. So I'll only look at something that's better than 4. Okay? And this guy is actually saying that if you continue in this direction, the best you would do is 4 or less. So there's no point in continuing. So there is no, see, one of the things about winning games is each win is considered to be equally good. Okay, there's no aesthetics of winning, okay, in the min-max tree at any rate. So if you have a win, if you have a way of getting 4 points already, then you are not interested in looking for other ways of getting 4 points. You're only interested in getting other ways of getting more points than 4. Okay. So that's very important to note that at the equality too, you would just cut. Okay, the alpha beta pruning occurs when the beta bound of a min node, for example, in this case, the beta bound of this node is less than or equal to an alpha bound of an ancestor, less than or equal to. Okay? So that's a very nice thing an important thing to realize. And then, so you cut this, and when you cut this, of course, you never have seen this tree. Okay, remember again that when you cut, the way this entire tree would have been enumerated, you would have seen it piece by piece. When you cut here, you didn't even know what was here. You had no clue. And as I said last time, that's the only way to cut. If you have to look before cutting, then you have done all the work already. Okay? In a picture like this, you see what you're cutting. But, when you are actually enumerating, you just say, at this point, I would not further expand this node. That's it. And as for all you care, this could have had a huge possible subtree right there. But that's fine. It's gone. Because you could not have gotten any better than what you have. Okay? And so at this point, once you cut, in essence, all you can actually assume that at this point, this is indeed the real value per C. Okay? It may not actually be the real value. In fact, if you had looked at this side, you may have found that there is a way of even driving down C's backed up value. Do you understand that? Okay? But it doesn't matter, because the whole point is C will never be on the main line of play anymore. The moment you cut a node, that means it's never going to be on the main line of the play. So its real backed up value is of no interest to you. Okay, so you act as if the bound is the real value, but it really isn't in this case. Okay, and then you come here, and at this point, you looked at this K. When you looked at K, you would get less than or equal to 3 here. And this guy is still greater than or equal to 4, this guy is less than or equal to 3 here, and so there is a cut. Now it turns out this cut is a small cut, but you don't know when you cut. In fact, in this case, you know the tree, so you know that, oh, this is just a little cut, it's a huge cut, but you would have actually looked at this point and said, yeah, I already have less than or equal to 3, which is less than the alpha bound higher up, so I'll cut. That's alpha beta pruning, okay? Now, as long as we are at this tree, notice an interesting thing about this tree. Is it uniform depth? No. Now, I actually made it sound last class that if you don't want to go all the way to the leaf nodes, then you may want to go to some depth and then stop there and then evaluate nodes at that depth and back it up. Okay. Now, if you remember, if you actually look, if you actually extend a tree until every leaf node is a definite end, definite win or lose or draw, would that tree necessarily be a uniform tree? It won't be uniform depth. Okay? And when you're cutting off, it's not necessary that you should cut off to uniform depth. Uniform depth is an easy thing to cut off at. Okay, it's always easy to just assume that, okay, I'll go up to depth 5 in all directions and I'll stop. But in fact, so there are 2 points to remember. Point one is alpha beta pruning works irrespective of whether these values, these nodes are terminal nodes or whether they are just evaluations for the terminal, evaluations for the middle node. It doesn't matter. Alpha beta pruning works for both complete min-max and depth limited min-max. Okay, point one. And point two is even if you are in the business of actually doing limited depth min-max, which is what you're going to do most of the time because you cannot grow the tree all the way to the leaf node all the time. It's not necessary that you should go to the same depth in all directions. You could say in some parts of the tree I would go deeper, in some other parts I will go shallower. So I might say my nominal depth is 5. In some places I will go to 5 and stop, in other places I might go up to 7 or up to 9. Okay, so in some sense that's what happened in this tree. You know, I may have the nominal depth is here, but in this and in this branch for some reason I went down further. Now the question is, why would I want to do it? And if I do want to do it, how would I get how much extra depth I should go to? Okay. The reason why I might want to do it is because it's possible that as you are growing the tree, remember this tree corresponds to some real game. Okay, as you're growing the tree, this line of play might be volatile. That means it looks as if right now you have the advantage. One more look ahead, you become a loser. Another look ahead, you are a winner. Okay, so basically it's just because you're looking one step ahead, it looks like you're going to win the game. Two steps ahead, it looks like you're going to lose the game. Three steps ahead, you're going to win the game again. Now, there is actually this entire line of play probably either will go to a win or a lose or a draw. But when you are going limited depth, it looks as if the value could be changing. Okay? In those scenarios, what happens is essentially that particular line of the play is sort of volatile. Right now, it's sort of there are tactical moves that people can make that can change the value of the move. And so in those scenarios, you want to go forward until the point where the value stabilizes. Okay? So this is where you use this idea called quiescence. So you would say, I would grow the tree and basically to the nominal depth of, say, 5, whatever your depth limit is. And then if at that point the value on that branch is not stabilized, it's changing wildly. If it is changing wildly, then I will go a couple more ply in those directions. Okay? That's called quiescent search and it's regularly used in most game programs. Okay? Now the only question that I haven't answered to you is how exactly do I decide whether or not the line of play has stabilized. What does it mean? What does it mean to say that a line of play has stabilized? Here is an idea. If you stop right here, this node you could have applied. Suppose this is tic-tac-toe. If you stop right here, you could apply the evaluation function to this node, which is the number of rows, columns, diagonals open to me minus number of rows, columns, diagonals open to my opponent. And I'll get a number there. Okay? Let's say that's 3. Now I extend it one more level. At this point, I compute the evaluations here, back it up here. So I get a new estimate for the same node. To the extent this line of play isn't changing, the backed up value should be close to the original estimate. You guys see this? Okay, so upfront I may have had a 4, upfront I may have had a 3, and then I extended it up to this level, now its value has become 4. So it's like a small change. Suppose it turns out that upfront this value was minus 3, and then I extended it one level, and I backed up, and its value estimate became 4. That's like a wild swing, minus 3 to plus 4 in one level. So it's probably worth going one more level deep and see whether the game will stabilize. Okay? This is really a band-aid. Quiescent search is a band-aid. Because ultimately, whenever you do limited depth look ahead, I can always make a pathological game where you would do the wrong thing. Because in essence, the depth will let you push the inevitable one level deeper than the level you are looking at. And the famous example for this is put yourself in the shoes of on the side of Allies during Second World War time, before Second World War started, and our friend Hitler is taking over one after other country. Okay, so country one is about to be taken, and Allies are thinking, should we wage a war, or should we let him take the country? Maybe after that he'll stop. Who knows? Maybe, he's a good guy. He'll just take this country and he'll stop. Okay, so they actually waited. I mean, we are laughing right now, but they waited. I mean, it's very nice to rewrite history books and thinking that we were always on the right side of the history, but we weren't. Nobody was on the right side of history all the way. We started Second World War way, way too late. Okay, wars aren't great, but Hitler was basically not stopped right away. I mean, he took as many countries plus more, and he killed as many people plus more. And at some point of time, we decided to wage a war. But one way of understanding the reasoning behind that would be you're only looking fixed depth ahead. And you're thinking, we can always postpone the inevitable beyond your horizon. Okay? And it looks as if the hard choice that you have to make can be pushed beyond the horizon. And this is actually called horizon effect. And all limited search, limited depth, all limited depth searches have to deal with horizon effect. And everybody has to do limited depth search because there is not enough resources in the world to do full depth search. Okay, so this is the problem that you just have to deal with, but sometimes you can sort of take band-aids to avoid some of the bad problems of horizon effect by doing things, for example, like quiescent search. So that in directions where the value of the game is changing quickly, you do more look ahead. Now notice that this is very different from doing all the directions to the same extra depth B. I mean, suppose instead of doing five, if you say, instead of doing five, I'll do eight across the board, then that's very bad because now instead of B power five, you have B power eight as the search tree size. But you're only going in some of the directions for that extra depth. That's called quiescent search, and you get to do that as an extra credit portion for your project 2. Okay. One other related point is this: even after quiescent search, as I told you, even after quiescent search, horizon effect is not removed. So it's possible that suppose, I went first, it was, let's say 3, and I went one level deep, it became 4, and I say, 3 to 4, not too much of a change, it stabilized, I won't go further down. Okay, maybe if I went one extra level, it would have gone from 4 to minus 7. I can make a game where that will be the case. Okay, so you would never really, really know that, you've done the right thing. Anytime you do limited depth look ahead, you'll never really, really know if you could do the right thing. I mean, the temptation is great to say, let me just go all the way, a little bit more. But if you go a little bit more, the only right place you can end is if all the leaf nodes are terminal nodes, which is impossibly large for most reasonable games. Okay, it's fun to make fun of Allies the way I just did earlier. But on the other hand, there have been scenarios in the history where somebody would take a couple of countries and stop. And so it was actually good in those cases to have waited. So you would never know really, which would have been the right choice unless you do the full search. Okay. So now suppose I did do quiescent and I picked the best move and I'm about to make this move. If it is chess, the worst that can happen is you might lose the game. If this is much bigger game where your entire assets are going to be lost if you lose this, then you might want to ask yourself, you know, I'm about to make a move, right? Can I check if this move can be confirmed to be having the value it I thought has? So I know that horizon effect can exist, but I really want to know, now that I have decided to go in this particular direction, am I going to be affected by horizon effect? Which is a different question than saying, can I avoid horizon effect completely? Okay? And to answer that question, you first understand a very interesting point about min-max search, which is, when you make a move at the top level, first of all, you make the move, in this particular case, what move would you have made? In this particular case, you would have made the move to go to B. That's because the backed up value 4 came from B. Now, the backed up value that the root node has corresponds to the evaluation of one of these children in the tree. That's an interesting point that's true in min-max tree. Whatever is the value that this guy gets is the actual value of one of these guys. In this particular case, this guy is the reason I got 4. So if your boss, you know, you are in an organization with large number of people, hierarchy of people, and then your boss is trying to outbid somebody else based on one particular low-level employee saying, you know, I can take care of this little code, oh, $10, you know, max, you know, and, you know, I'll get done this code for you. And so he used that number, and using that, he was able to outbid your opposing team. Just before submitting the bid, the boss wants to ask, are we sure? Can we do this? And he might ask, he or she might ask, the reason we seem to be doing so much better is because this one guy said $10 for this code, so let me go and quiz this guy. Are you sure? Do you know what you are promising? Okay? We do this sort of thing. And similarly, in this min-max search, I would ask this guy, I'll stare at E strongly and say, are you sure? You said 4, I'm about to make an entire move based on your evaluation value. Are you sure your value is 4? How do you ask a node, are you sure your value is 4? You do search starting from E, a few more depths, and back it up, and see if the backed up value is close to 4. If so, then you know that, yeah, pretty much this is fine. If you actually looked at E and then you went a couple of levels deep and backed up and found that the backed up value is minus infinity, then you know it's not fine. But do you know what else to do then? No. You just know that you're about to sink. That's all you know. You understand what I'm saying? So this idea of staring at the employee, it's too late. I mean, the deadline is ready. I'm about to submit my bid. All I know now, essentially, is E, basically, the evaluation for E was suspect. And so I at least know that if I have a few more minutes, let me re-up. I mean, so basically, I can do the correct value for E and redo them in max for that, for example, and see what's the better move. But then that guy, too, could be suspect. So you have to stare at them. Okay? This is just like this is called a secondary search. This idea of staring at E and making sure that the value that it let up is really its true value is called secondary search. Okay? And so look at all these beautiful terms we are learning now. And secondary search is really kind of, you are doing the secondary search hoping that it would say everything is fine. It's like in the middle of the night, you wake up and you put on the lights to check if somebody is there, and you're hoping that there is nobody in your home. You see what I'm saying? So it's like secondary search is like that. If there is somebody there, you know, God help you, especially, you know, if you don't have too many guns in your home. You know, what are you going to do? So secondary search is just telling you whether this guy, you know, is giving you extra confidence as to whether the move you made is based on the right guy. But this is actually a very interesting point about min-max, that the final move is dependent on a single guy's evaluation. If it wasn't min-max, if it was expecti-max, that means you do expectations here and max is there. Remember the RTDP? Then this is no longer true. because the expected value is a combination of probabilities and values. So it's much harder to stare at one single guy and yell at him or her. Okay, there was a raised hand. Yes, sir. Deciding.
For example, if we start processing the right now.
This is about alpha beta pruning.
Yes.
Okay, now I'm going to get to that. Okay. So I started with alpha beta pruning, but then I started talking about all these things which are essentially what depth to stop the search. Okay, but there is this other point about alpha beta I'll come to. Yes. Well, in the secondary search, you can go, it's a very interesting thing. Quiescent search is about the past. It's like, what's the most important rule about stock market that nobody follows? And I don't know why I'm talking to you about this, because probably you don't have money to invest. But everybody tries to invest in the stock that has done well in the last 6 months. Okay? But if you have good friends who are running the company and are about to declare bankruptcy, you know a lot more useful information that the right time is now to sell. It's the future that matters. Quiescence is all about the past. Secondary search is all about the future. Okay? All we are saying is a stock which is changing up and down very quickly is likely to be changing more in the future. But a stock which has been stable until now does not have to stay stable. It could fall down. So a value which has been stable at this level and the next level back up may still change. And now that you made, you bet your house or your farm on E, you want to ask E, are you sure? Okay. And you can't do secondary search for everybody. If you do secondary search for every node, that's like increasing the depth across the board, which you would not do that. Okay? Yes, sir.
Isn't the secondary search believe that it's not an optimal node? Couldn't we just back up and pick another node?
Exactly. That's what you have to do. But it's kind of oftentimes too late. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, because normally the optimal thing to do would be, if you have exactly 10 minutes for your move, you would use 9 minutes, 50 seconds to do as deep a tree as you can. And back up, and you're pretty much done at this point. And when you're asking E, are you sure, it's a rhetorical question. You're hoping that the answer would be yes. And you're unlucky and he said no, in which case you have all of 4 seconds left, or you're going to eat up into your, you know, in terms of, you know, chess, etc., you are eating up into your other move time or something. You understand? I mean, it's like the beauty of game trees is it brings directly into relief the issue of resource crunch. In A star search, we were talking about, does it work for 3 days? I mean, does it run for 3 days or 4 days? Just make sure that you don't run out of memory. But here, that's not the issue. Here, the issue is you have resource crunch. You have your time to make your move is on you, and you have to make the move. Which also, by the way, goes back to another question that I asked on blog, and only one guy, I think you, answered, which is, why is it that we still cannot solve 24 puzzle problems under reasonable time, but we can win chess games? I mean, we being the computer. I don't know why I'm thinking of me as a computer, but, you know, we the computer programmers are able to write programs which are the world's chess champions, and yet we cannot write a program that solves a 24 puzzle problem for, you know, reasonably fast. Why? The answer is very clear. In chess, we are competing against dumb people, that is all. Right? And we just need to be a little less dumb than the opponent to win the game. In 24 puzzle, there is no opponent. You just have to find the optimal solution. That's a much harder problem in some sense. Okay? In fact, you know, it's like the same thing. I mean, it's not necessarily the case that Google is actually doing anything like good web search. It's just that Google's opponent sucks. And Google is epsilon better than them. And so they get the entire market share. And yet we just still don't know how to prove P equal to NP. Because P equal to NP's proof doesn't depend upon their being opponents or not opponents. Either you prove it or you don't prove it. Do you understand? So it's like, in some sense, having opponents is easy because you just need to be slightly smarter than the dumb guy across from you. Okay, that's an interesting point to keep in mind. Oftentimes we tend to think that resource crunches are bad, opponents are bad, but sometimes they make your life easy because expectations are lowered. Okay. Properties of alpha beta pruning. One of these is, we started talking about it last class, how much can, if you are just doing alpha beta pruning on any old tree, how much can you cut down? How many nodes could you have cut down? And it turns out that that depends very much on the order in which, the order in which you looked at the nodes. So in fact, if you go back to the previous slide, had you looked at the tree starting this side, okay, what would have happened is by the time you come here, your bound would have been greater than or equal to 3. Greater than or equal to 3, not greater than or equal to 4. And so when you came here, you couldn't have cut this. You understand? It was because you came from this side, you got it. So in general, alpha beta pruning's best case occurs if you happen to have fortuitously picked the very best move for every max and min node. So if you search the tree in the order of the best moves for the max and min nodes, okay, then you get the maximum pruning. If not, you cannot, in the worst case, you would get zero pruning, no pruning. It's just as bad as, you know, min-max, full min-max. If you search it in the order of the best to worst move values, then you win big. The two questions are, what do you mean by win big? How much can you win? Okay, and how much can you win is what we were discussing last class. This is how the tree would look if you are the luckiest kid on earth and you did look at the best moves for everybody first. So, and it's interesting to note that, for example, here it must have looked at the entire subtree here. There's no other way. And then you would have gotten the real value here, which would have gotten you a bound there, which would then be used to cut this as soon as you looked at one here. And then similarly, it would cut these two as soon as you looked at one here, at which point you would have gotten a bound there, and that bound can be used to cut this entire tree as soon as you looked at this subtree. So it doesn't look as nice as you might have thought. I mean, you know, it's like the best would have been, you know, it's like you go directly to the move. It's not the case. You know, there are a large number of nodes that you're still looking at. Now, exactly how many are there? You know, it is left to, you know, somebody like Don Knuth. How many of you have heard Donald Knuth's name in your data structures course? Yeah. So Donald Knuth essentially sat down and did an analysis on alpha beta pruning. He drew this picture, is actually, you know, stolen from his paper. And he essentially said, look guys, if you look at this, you know, all these dotted lines, they are not expanded. All the dark ones are expanded. So he made the following thing. In the best case, alpha beta examines only those nodes such as their Dewey decimal representation has ones in all even or all odd positions. It is true. If you look at this thing, now the representation is, this is null, 1, 2, 3, this is 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, this is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 3, and so on. So it will only look at the nodes which have all ones in all the even or all the odd positions. And it turns out that there are b power d by 2 nodes which have nodes such that they have ones in all odd positions, and another b power d by 2 node such that they have ones in all the even positions. Among them you counted, I mean this has to be an algorithms guy. You know, you're talking about exponential stuff and he says, well, you have counted this a little too many times, twice. Okay, so b power d by 2 floor plus b power d by 2 ceiling minus 1 is the exact number of nodes you would have expanded. And now you do, you know, obvious approximation, and you say this is really equal to 2 times b power d by 2, which is the order of b power d by 2. So instead of, in the very best case, instead of expanding b power d nodes on a tree of depth d, instead of expanding b power d nodes, alpha beta pruning would expand b power d by 2 nodes. This can be seen as two different ways. One way, you can think of this as root b power d, which means, in essence, it's searching on a tree whose branching factor is square root of the original tree. Or you can think of it as, if I have the time, if I'm given the same time, I can now go twice as deep before running out of the time. This is in the best case. So in the best case, alpha beta pruning can go twice as deep. And you know how big that is. We talked about the difference between a good chess player and the grandmaster is essentially 4 moves deep extra.
Only in the best case.
This is in the best case. So there are two issues. One is, what's the best case, and second is, how do you get it? So I'm going to talk about that last part, and then we'll be done with game trees. Okay? So yes, this is the nirvana that you're trying to aim for. The question is, how do you get it? To get this, you must look at the tree in the order of best moves first. But then, if you know the best moves, then why the heck are you doing search? Okay? So we use our heuristic cap, and we say, look, you believe that evaluation function is close to the reality, right? To the extent you believe that the evaluation function is close to the reality, use the evaluation function to permute the queue, to prioritize the queue. You understand what I'm saying? So as soon as you have developed, as soon as you expanded this node to get these 3 nodes, you apply the evaluation function. If it's tic-tac-toe, it is number of rows, diagonals, columns open to you minus number of rows, diagonals, columns open to your opponent. And see which of them will have a higher number corresponding to that evaluation function, and expand that guy first in the depth first order. And to the extent your evaluation function is close to the true value, this is as close as you can get to alpha beta pruning. This is what you would do in your project 2. Okay? So it's like you would use the evaluation function on the middle layer. The original min max only says that you should look at the evaluation function, apply evaluation function only to these nodes. But now I am saying you should apply the evaluation function to every interior node too. But I have said that for two different reasons. One, for quiescent search. If you want to do quiescent search, you have to apply evaluation function to the interior nodes. The second is to prioritize the nodes and decide the order in which depth first search looks at the children. But for both cases, all you're doing is you're going to apply the evaluation function not only to the leaf nodes, but also to the interior nodes. And we know that there are only just as many interior nodes as there are leaf nodes. So at most, you would have evaluated double the number, which is still better than evaluating exponentially extra number. But the promise of this is quiescence can be achieved, and also you could get the best alpha beta pruning. Now, the last comment is, if you do alpha beta pruning, would your optimal, the move that you choose, would it change if you did alpha beta pruning versus you did not do alpha beta pruning? No, it doesn't. It doesn't modulo all equal quality moves being equally valued. Okay? If there is another 4 here and a 4 here, then each of them are considered equal. Modulo that, the value doesn't change. Furthermore, in fact, you can actually show that the backed up value for the root node would be the same whether you used alpha beta pruning or not. But the backed up values for the interior node may not be the same, because as I said here, I didn't actually back up everything to this guy. So this guy will end saying I'm around 4. But I don't really care what your value is anyway, because the root node's value doesn't depend on you anymore. Now here's the other question. Something like alphabet of pruning. I mean, I went into min-max saying RTDP does expectation maximization, right, in the RTDP. And min-max does minimization maximization. And it's supposed to be a special case for RTDP. The question is, could you have done min-max for RTDP? Could you have done something like alpha-beta pruning for RTDP? If you find out, if you can, come and talk to me. You can write paper. You know, it's like the minimization maximization has this nice property in terms of bounds. In the RTDP, this doesn't exist. And in fact, even this idea of secondary search doesn't exist in RTDP, because you can say a huge number of people were responsible for my wrong move, not a single person, or not a single node. And in min-max, it's always a single node which is responsible for you actually going in this direction. So there is some advantage for going in min-max. I'm not saying that you should always use min-max. I'm saying if you happen to be using min-max, you can use alpha-beta pruning. Okay. Just an extra slide. In fact, I've been using the word expective max, that sort of non-standard usage. If you actually have, so I played this game where RTDP was seen as a game between the agent and the nature. But you could have two-player games where there is an element of chance. Okay? So your move depends on what the dice says you can do, for example. You know, you throw a pair of dice, and then based on the value they come up with, you decide what moves are possible. And then make the best move among them. Okay? If you do that, in essence, the tree would look like this. This is the max's turn, and then max basically does, then there is a coin tossing going on. And based on the coin tossing, either I get to take this move or this move, or this move or this move. And for each of these moves, min can do something. So this is max, min, expect. So max, expecti, min tree. Max, chance, min tree. And in this case, the way you would back up would be, of course, min always does the minimization. By the way, notice that in our terminology, in our picture, minimization is shown as a downward triangle. You know, if you're looking for mnemonics in life, that's a good thing. It's driving down the value. And the max is an upward triangle. So it's up, you know, driving up the value. Okay? So min always takes the min, and then max always takes the max. This guy takes the expectation. The chance node basically takes the expectation. And you can do much of this analysis there too. Okay? Good. Any questions on this stuff? I normally end with a slide about the status of the deterministic games, but I already did that. I told you already where the status of computer games is. So that, for example, that Go is impossible to solve even for deterministic games, and you can talk to Will. And then chess is right in the cusp, so it's still worth playing between humans and computers. And games like Othello are gone all over the other side, that humans don't want to play computers because computers are so much better. It's like, you know, one of the interesting things is there is somewhere in the textbook, in the beginning, or somewhere it's written, this point is written that I think Ed Fredkin has said this, that we no longer have weightlifting competitions between machines and humans. Like the smallest little weightlifting machine can do much better weightlifting than I can. At the time of these Greek heroes, you know, the humans were the only things which could lift. And then Archimedes came along and said, you know, look, we can do this leverage. And so then it was over. You know, humans are no longer the people who can lift the biggest weight. And we seem to get along with that fine. You know, we no longer got depressed. You know, I mean, I think people are still depressed that I can't lift as much of a weight as this other friend of mine. They never say I can't lift as much of a weight as my, whatever those things are, the crane, you know. Nobody is depressed, okay? And similarly, we no longer are the fastest in terms of running. You know, like this cheapo motorcycles are way better than us, right? So we should come to terms with the fact that we are also not the best chess players. You know, and it's not surprising. You know, once we figure out how to play this game, you know, and write the computer programs, then it's fine. But every step of the way, presumably, we want to put up a fight. And, you know, that's why there's a beautiful article which, did I send you guys Drew McDermott's article about what does it mean that Deep Blue is now the chess champion? If not, and I should send it to you. There was, at the time, Deep Blue won the world, I mean, basically won over Kasparov. There's all sorts of interesting arguments in the popular press as to whether this should mean anything or not. And of the many articles that were written, I like the one that Drew McDermott, who is actually also a very well-known researcher in AI, that he's written. And I think I'll send that to you guys. You can look at it. Yes?
Since we're on Deep Blue, I just had a question. You were talking about Deep Blue in relation with all these searches, but I was reading somewhere that Deep Blue was actually reprogrammed between games to...
Really?
Yeah.
No, first of all, if it is, then how does it matter? Does it matter? I mean, can we tell Kasparov not to think of the game after the one game to the next game? Wipe your head clean? You know, we can't. You know, the real question, of course, is how much of it was hand-coded between games? I would be interested in seeing any write-up on that. Yes, Will? Yeah, okay.
So at the time of Deep Blue, you could make the opinion that computers are better if you specifically come to Taylor to take out one guy. At this time, computers are just better.
Better. Yeah, no, I mean, in fact, the funny thing is Deep Blue required like a supercomputer. I mean, like a, you know, custom VLSI chip from IBM. But now all these, you know, PC games are better than, I mean, are almost at the same league. But what's interesting and somewhat depressing really is, as I said, part of the win for chess did not come from evaluation function learning. It came from just brute force going a few ply deeper, at least the original Deep Blue's win. Okay. And if you ask any of the grandmasters, how do they win the game, they never admit saying, oh, I just brute force went a few more ply deeper than my opponent. They would say something much more colorful, saying, you know, I am bestowed with this beautiful vision, and, you know, I see patterns, and I see this, and apparently computers are still not seeing this pattern. Okay, but you should, you know, I'll send you Drew McDermott's article. It's very interesting. You should read that. It's a New York Times op-ed. Okay, any questions? Yes. Yes, you should find Kasparov's opinion too. Yeah. In fact, I think in my first slide for the, I don't have it anymore, I must have missed it. Kasparov is actually famously has been quoted at one point of time that I could feel true intelligence across the board. And then after that, he changed his mind. But sorry. But at some point of time, at least, he sort of said that. Okay. Okay. So we're going to... We basically got by with the least amount of representation of knowledge until now. We started from problem-solving agent, which essentially has black box child generator function, black box goal test function, okay, and then pushed it a bunch along. Then we looked at what happens if my state have some structure, but basically rudimentary structure in terms of state variables. And that was planning. That little structure got us kinds of heuristics that you could not have gotten if you just have black box child generator function. Okay, and then we also did essentially adversarial search again as a problem solving agent model. Okay, until now we haven't seriously, other than this little shift during planning where we said states actually may have structures, we have avoided getting into the issue of representing the state and reasoning with the knowledge that's there in the state. Now, even in the case of planning, if you notice, right, even in something as simple as a blocks world, even something as simple as a blocks world, you should be able to say that if A is on B, then A is not on C. All of us understand that about blocks world. A, how do you say this in the model that we were looking at earlier? And B, if you could use that, in fact, you could cut down some of the bad branches. Okay, I mean, why can't we write that? And furthermore, in fact, something like clear B it's a state variable which is really dependent on other state variables' values. When I normally think of the representation of a state, it's made up of 10 state variables. I would like to think that those 10 state variables are in some sense independent dimensions. So within the state, they are not correlated. Right? And yet, if you look at in the case of clear B, really it's very directly correlated with the on X B for all X. Okay, in particular, clear B if and only if for all X not on X B. I'm writing for all X, this is, you know, we are not supposed to know this syntax, but on the other hand, you guys have seen some of these sorts of syntax. So I would like to just say that clear B is a derived property, and I could have some primary properties of the state, and I could reason with the primary properties to derive new properties. That could be quite useful. Okay. For all these reasons, we will start looking at the idea that the agent has declarative representation of its knowledge and would try to reason with it. And as usual, we'll start again from the fundamentals and go as far as we can. So the idea that in a knowledge-based agent, instead of a problem-solving agent, in a what we call the goal-based or knowledge-based agent, is you sort of write down in some language everything that you know about the problem. Okay? And then you ask whether something is true, given what I told you. Okay? And so there should be like a language in which you write the knowledge, and there should be some inference mechanism which puts together sentences to derive new sentences in this language. Okay, if given certain sentences, it should be able to tell whether a certain new sentence is true or false. Okay, for now we will restrict our attention to sentence being true or false, but as we go on, we'll also look at sentence being likely or not likely, and how likely is it. Currently, we'll look at fully likely, that's one probability, or completely unlikely, that means zero probability. Okay? So this basically, this is called the declarative approach because you're sort of saying all you know about the world, and then you have worked out inference mechanisms, and then all the question would be, tell what it needs to know, ask it, and then the agent can ask itself what should be the right action given what I know. And for it to be able to ask this question and answer it, you need to understand inference mechanisms. And inference and representation go hand in hand. Okay, and that's like the general high level point. Now, the question is, if you do this, what happened to search? What happened to search? Do knowledge-based agents do search? What? So some years back, I think a couple of years back, three, four years back, in UK, there was a a popular poll to find out the world's funniest joke. How many of you remember what was the world's funniest joke? You guys have a life? So what's the world's funniest joke? So they came up with the following world's funniest joke. There was a particular joke which won the competition. I mean, the UK guys have time on their hands. We only take part in should Bush be thrown out or kept. That's the only poll that we want to take part in. But, you know, UK guys also vote on these sorts of things. And so the, according to them, the world's funniest joke is the following Sherlock Holmes joke, which I should tell you now. So Sherlock Holmes and Watson go on a camping trip, okay? And they have walked around, they did their trekking, etc., etc. In the evening, you know, they pitched their tent, they made their food, they had the food, they sang their camp songs, and they went to sleep. Middle of the night, Sherlock Holmes wakes up, nudges Watson, and tells Watson, look up and tell me what you see and tell me what you can deduce from what you see. And Watson looks up and says that, I see the clear blue sky full of stars, and this tells me that there are so many possible stars that there must be some other place where there is intelligent life, which also then means the following thing, that, you know, we should not always assume that we are the only intelligent life in the world, and which also should mean that we should do our best to look for intelligent life, all this stuff. And then Sherlock Holmes looks at Watson and says, Watson, you idiot, this means that somebody swiped our tent. Okay? Why did I tell you this? Other than the fact that I like to tell jokes, why did I tell you this? Because given a bunch of knowledge, many, 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 many things can be deduced. But the important thing that you want to deduce is what you're interested in. If you're looking for what should I do based on deducing every possible, inferring every possible sentence, and from that inferring more sentences, and from that inferring more sentences, you would be like Watson, who would, by the end of the night or end of the century, would have figured out the one most important thing, which is that somebody stole the tent. Okay? The other things are not wrong inferences at all. It's just they're not leading to any goal, any important goal. And in particular, just because you have an inference procedure doesn't mean that it's going to infer what would be the most relevant thing for you. You need goal-directed inferencing. To do that, you need search. In fact, we will talk about search again and again during knowledge-based agents too. The search is often buried in the inference engine. It basically, the search is guiding what inferences to make and which ones to change to get to the relevant knowledge. Okay? So it's not that the search has gone away, it's just, you know, we buried it underneath the inference engine. Okay. So if you do have a language and an inference engine, you can use that language to represent the states, the actions. You can use that language to tell that I just learned more things from my perception. You can use that to update the representation of the world. That means you can update the state information. You can use that language and the inference procedure to sort of deduce derived properties are hidden properties. So for example, clear may not be a property that you could perceive, but if somebody is on top of this, then it's not clear. So you could actually deduce the hidden properties, and ultimately you can deduce appropriate actions that you're supposed to be doing. The most likely, the best actions that you should be doing. And in the end, it all boils down to what do I do now? That's it. You know, for any intelligent agent, the multi-billion dollar question is, what do I do now? Given all that I know, what do I do now? Okay. So let's talk about logic in general, and then we'll quickly come down to propositional logic, and we'll look at it once again, even though you've looked at propositional logic lots of times, but obviously we'll look at it in a different way, hopefully. Okay, and then that will lead us to other things like first-order logic and probabilistic logic, which is Bayesian logic. Okay, so any general logic is a language with an inference procedure associated with it, and you need a syntax and you need a semantics. Syntax is a bunch of rules. You can decide what the syntax is, and you know, you can tell whether a parser can then tell whether a sentence is syntactically correct or not. Now the semantics of course is much more interesting. So for example, x plus 2 greater than or equal to y is a sentence. X2 plus y greater than is not a sentence because it's syntactically incorrect. Okay, now what about 2 plus 2 greater than or equal to 7? 2 plus 2 greater than or equal to 7. It's a syntactically correct sentence. So what else is, what else can I say about it? 2 plus 2 is greater than or equal to 7. It's false. There's nothing wrong with the sentence. It's just that semantically there is no word where that sentence is true. In fact, that brings up the issue of how do we talk about meaning of sentences. The best way to think of meaning of sentences is to say that a sentence, you have essentially some set of words, and given a sentence, that sentence is constraining your attention to only a subset of those set of words where that sentence holds to be true. So the meaning of the sentence is essentially the words in which it is true. A meaning of a knowledge base, which is a sequence of such sentences, is essentially the meaning of, so you can think of, if you have a bunch of sentences which are all put together present in the knowledge base, that means it's a conjunctive sentence. It is a sentence which is an and of all the sentences. Which then means that the meaning of the entire knowledge base would be the intersection of the words for each of these sentences. Do you understand this? So think of, as soon as you see a sentence in a logic, think of it as coming with a set, which is the set of words where it is true. You add in one more sentence, if this also should be true, then it comes up with its own set of words where it should be true. And if both of them have to be true, then the words that they can both be true is the intersection of the first two sets of words. Okay? So at the lowest level, this is what you want to understand. You know, essentially, a sentence represents a set of possible words. You adding another sentence, which also must be true at the same time as this sentence, cuts down the number of possible words. And you can cut down the number of possible words up to empty set, which means there is no world where this sentence actually holds true. Okay? Now, my normal question whenever I have logic is, given a set of sentences in my logic, and given, you know, sentence S1, S2, S3 in some logic, and I give you S4, and I want to ask you, given that you know that S1, S2, S3 are true, is S4 also true? Given that you know S1, S2, S3 are true, is S4 also true? Or in particular, can you tell me that knowing S1, S2, S3 are true, can you tell me whether S4 would be true? And the way you answer that essentially is, when S1, S2, and S3 are true, that means you're talking about the set of words where all three sentences hold, which is the intersection of sets of words for each of the sentences. Now just look at those words, W1, W2, up to W10. If S7 is true in each of those 10 words, then as far as you're concerned, it's entailed. That means whenever these guys are true, this guy is true. Because the moment these guys are true, I know I'm talking about the words W1 to W10. And in all of those words, S7 is true. And so S7 is entailed. Okay? Now, you could actually extend these notions and say, so the picture is this. So the words where a sentence is true, you call those the models of the sentence. Okay? Each sentence comes up with a set of the models where the sentence is actually true. Okay? And if you have a conjunction of sentences, you're taking the intersection of these models. That would then be the model for the entire knowledge base. And you want to ask if the sentence that you're trying to prove to be true, is it also holding in all those words? If so, then it is true. If not, it's not. Now, here's the interesting question. Suppose I, in my example that I was just talking, I have 10 words. You know, there are a total of 10 words where my knowledge base holds. Okay? 9 of those words, S7 is true. 1, it's not true. then is it logically entailed? From a first order, from the normal logic point of view, it's not entailed, because there exists at least one world. There exists at least one world where the knowledge base is true, but the sentence you are trying to prove is not true. Now, suppose there is sentence S9 which only holds in one of those 10 worlds. As far as logic is concerned, both of them are not entailed. And you might say, really, S7 is slightly more entailed than S9. And if you want to do that, you start talking about likelihood, you start talking about probabilistic logic. But for now, we'll only talk about the propositional first order logic, where entailment is an all or nothing proposition. That means you can say that something is entailed if it is true in every model of the knowledge base. Now suppose the set of models for my knowledge base is empty. That means my knowledge base is Rav is wearing green shirt, Rav is not wearing green shirt. That's my knowledge base. Both sentences are true in my knowledge base. So the number of worlds which are consistent with my knowledge base now is empty. Now I want to ask, is Bush the greatest man in the world? That's the sentence I want to prove. Okay? Is it proved or not? All that entailment says is, in every world where the knowledge base is true, the sentence is also true. The world where the knowledge base is true is empty. In that, Bush is. The Bush is the greatest president is also true. The greatest man in the world is also true. So it's vacuously true. So this is part of the reason why, if the knowledge base is inconsistent, if the knowledge base is inconsistent, which means it corresponds to empty set of models, then everything holds. Everything is entailed. And everybody thinks of this as like a bug in logic. It's not a bug in logic. It makes sense. You know, the way you define entailment, it makes perfect sense. Okay? Now, so the question is, I already told you, without actually deciding what syntax and semantic of a logic are, I already talked about how to talk about entailment in such a logic. Okay, which is talk about models and talk about whether the new sentence holds in every model of the knowledge base. That's it. And it's all Venn diagram intersection. Okay? So the question then is, and then this ultimately is the main question you want to answer. This is the heart of inference. In any logic, you have a bunch of sentences that are thrown into the knowledge base, and you're asking if an extra sentence will hold to be true or false. That's your question. So if I can compute this, then I have essentially computed inference. That's the program for doing inference in that logic. Okay. So the question then is, how do I compute inference? It's not that hard. I told you, you know, you have a bunch of worlds. You know the bunch of worlds where your knowledge base is true. And for each of those worlds, check if your sentence is true. What could be a problem with this? What? How many is too many? Infinity is too many. When in doubt, say infinity. Okay? Infinity is too many worlds. And so enumeration of all worlds is nice conceptually, but it's not necessarily even theoretically feasible. But for propositional logic, it turns out that if you have n propositions, there are how many worlds? 2 power n possible worlds. For propositional logic, this is actually feasible. The moment you go to first order logic, it's not feasible. We'll talk about why that is the case. You know, it turns out that for first order logic, there could be infinite number of possible worlds. Yes, and so you would not check whether which is the set of infinite worlds where the knowledge base holds, and then check whether in each of those whether your sentence holds or not. Because what if you are unlucky and you checked infinity minus one of them and it all was holding, and then you fell asleep, and then the last one, it doesn't hold. Then you lose points in the exam. Ultimately, we only care about points in the exam, right? So clearly, there are, for propositional logic at least, there are, it seems, two obvious ways of doing inference, which is entail. Inference is another word for computing entailment. Okay? And entailment, of course, is like the most important thing, so you should draw a big picture of it and keep praying to it until this set of lectures are over. That's entailment. Don't pray to that, that's the wrong one. That's entailment. Okay, so the question is, you can do it in two ways. One, of course, is by checking the models themselves, which is what I've been explaining to you. The other is syntactic. Can I say that given the syntactic form of sentences, I can easily check whether a new syntactic sentence will be entailed or not? So the things, the way you always do logic, essentially, are of this form, right? A implies B, A is true, so I would say B is true, right? I mean, Greeks knew this, right? Now, this is a inference rule. If I have an inference rule, I can, if my inference rule is connected to the, so the entailment is ultimately correctly defined by model checking. I would say an inference rule is sound if whatever it infers can be shown to be entailed by the model checking. I would say it is complete if everything that can be shown to be entailed by the model checking is actually, can actually be shown to be inferred by this inference procedure. Now, the beauty about these inference procedures are these are syntactic. I don't look at the rest of the database at all. I don't draw all the words. You know, this A implies B and A could be part of a knowledge base which has 10,000 propositions, A, B, and P1 to P9998. Okay? If you are into doing model checking, you would have considered 2 power 10,000 words, which is a very large table. And you would have seen, you know, all the words where the this holds and all the words where A holds and checking whether entailment holds. But I get to ignore the rest and I say, well, A implies B, A, B would definitely hold the rest of this local inference. All I need to do is when I write this inference rule, I check its soundness and completeness once and for all upfront by establishing it with respect to model checking, which is the entailment definition. Okay? If I get to make inference procedures which are both sound and complete, I'm a happy kid. Because then I never have to deal with models themselves. I can just deal with syntax directly. If I have to give up on something, what would you rather give up on? Soundness or completeness? What? So he wants to give up on completeness. Who wants to give up on soundness? Apparently Will wants to, so you should talk to him. But generally, we always want to give up, if we have to give up on one, we tend to give up on completeness. Okay? So anything that you add into the knowledge base is actually entailed. But everything entailed may not be added into the knowledge base by you. Okay? Modusponens, for example, is a sound inference rule. It's not complete inference rule. Although I haven't talked about the syntax of propositional logic, let me show you this slide and we'll come back to this again next time. Here are a bunch of inference rules for propositional logic, all of which are sound, but none of them are complete by themselves. In fact, modusponens, A implies B, okay, and A is true, means you can write B true. Just syntactically write B into the database. Okay. That's sound but not complete. Modus tollens is also sound. Okay, so A implies B, not B, that means not A. How about this? A implies B, not A. So not B. this is coming close to Python logic, but it's actually, it's not a very bad inference, it's just not logical, because there are other possible, there could be other possible reasons for B being true. So just because A is not true doesn't mean B would have to be untrue. However, if you're thinking about likelihood, if I didn't know, if you knew that A implies B, and if I come and tell you, by the way, I just checked A is not true, would you still believe that B is likely to be true? Your likelihood that you associate with the truth of B would reduce. So here is a case where plausibly, you know, plausible reasoning will say B is less likely to be true. But it's not B is not entailed, however. Okay? Chaining is another rule. These are all, this except this. This is actually not sound. Okay? These are sound, but none of them are complete. Okay? Complete but unsound. An example is Monty Python logic. You know, throw in anything. You know, make up sentences. You know, you take sentences from here, you know, pieces from here, pieces from here, make a new sentence, throw it in. Hopefully, monkeys will generate Shakespeare. So you can also generate correct sentences, but you'll also generate a huge number of totally nonsensical sentences. Let me end the class with an example of, not politically charged message, but a reason why you would need sound and complete inference procedure. Okay? So here are two sentences. If weapons of mass destruction are found, then the war is justified, which can be written, I guess, as W implies J. If the WMDs are not found, then the war is still justified, which can be written as not W implies J. Now, the question is J entailed? Given these two sentences, is J entailed? Obviously, yes. We have done this. But more importantly, can any of your rules prove this? Modus ponens, nah. Modus tollens, no. But if you put them all together, they can prove this. What I would like to know is there a single rule of inference, that if you repeatedly apply that again and again and again, it will prove everything that is provable. So it is both complete and sound. And it turns out that there is such a rule, it's called resolution. And I'll just show you the form. It says if P R Q is a sentence and P R and R R not Q is a sentence, then you can remove Q and not Q and write P R R. First, you can prove to yourself that resolution is a general case. Everything else that you have seen is subsumed by resolution rule. And second, of course, to prove that it is complete is much harder. You have to prove it by induction. But everything that is provable, you can actually prove it using resolution rule. When we come back to next class, we'll talk more about why resolution is complete, how to, just because it's complete doesn't necessarily mean that you would infer the right thing in the least amount of time. Because of the Sherlock Holmes example, you can still be busy inferring all nonsensical things. So we talk about how to control search in doing resolution theorem proving. Okay.